Hi, everybody. It's May 16, 2022, and today I am glad and privileged to be joined by three of the recipients of this year's Robert M. Sherman Young Pioneers Award that recognizes their innovation in Jewish education. It's a follow-on from last week's episode, which I'm sure you all enjoyed. But today's conversation focuses on a couple of things I just want to highlight now in this brief introduction. The first is that each of these recipients talks about, in some ways, how they got involved with this field of Jewish education because of the role that someone important and special in their lives played in proverbially tapping them on the shoulder to get them involved and engaged in Jewish education and Jewish life. The second thing which I think is really worth highlighting is something that's mentioned later on in the conversation when someone talks about the serendipity of Jewish education, that we as Jewish educations often plan and overplan and methodically plan for everything that we want to take place in our lesson, in our camp module, whatever it might be. But often it's that incidental encounter that really makes an indelible impression on somebody's life. And it's not as if it just appears. We actually plan for those moments. That serendipity is really planned for in so much of what we do in Jewish education. It's what one of my educator mentors spoke to me about when he talked about the most important part about summer camp is when you actually brush your teeth with your campers. And it's in those moments when those really important, valuable, personal, and often the most enduring conversations take place. So please sit back and enjoy today's conversation with these three recipients of the Young Pioneer Award.
This is Adapting, the Future of Jewish Education, a podcast from the Jewish Education Project, where we explore the big questions, challenges, and successes that define Jewish education. I'm David Breifman.
Today is another really special day for me as I am joined here by Amram Altman, Jessica Cohen, and Megan Sass, three of the five recipients of the Jewish Education Project's 2022 Robert M. Sherman Young Pioneers Award. The Young Pioneer Award recognizes innovative educators in Greater New York City, like these three pioneers, and they demonstrate a personal and professional commitment to great ideas that have made a significant impact on the communities in which they serve. Last week, I spoke to the other two recipients, Francie Goldberg and Emily Hausman, and I am sure that today's conversation will be just as enthralling. Amran is the Associate Director of Youth Programs at Keshet, Jessica is the Associate Director of Religious Education at Congregation Rod of Shalom, and Megan is the Tefillah Specialist and Young Family Song Leader at SAJ Judaism, that stands for all, and also works as an educator at several other Jewish institutions across New York City. You may or may not know about these organizations yet, but I am sure that by the end of today's conversation, you will not just know about our Young Pioneer Award winner, but the organizations in which they work in as well. So Amram, Jessica, and Megan, welcome to today's show.
Happy to be here, David.
Thanks so much for having us this morning.
It's great to be here.
Great. So let's get going and ask each of you to tell us what drew you specifically into the work that you're currently involved with. Jessica, let's start with you.
I was fortunate enough to be really involved with my congregation growing up in high school and found out pretty quickly that I loved working with kids. I loved being involved in my synagogue, and it felt like a really natural path to make this my career. So it's kind of what I've always wanted to do.
And just tell us a bit about Congregation Rod of Shalom for those who don't know it.
Sure. Congregation Rod of Shalom is a Reform congregation on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. It is 180 years old. We serve a really wonderful community, and it's a wonderful place to be.
And I'm sure nothing has changed in 180 years of that congregation's existence.
No, it's exactly the same as the day it started.
All right. So we'll talk about those changes over time as well during the course of the conversation. So Amram, what drew you into your work?
The summer going into 11th grade, I was part of a summer program at Brandeis University. And it was there that I met a couple of Jewish educators who really saw something in me and connected me to Keshet right at the time when Keshet was starting its first ever LGBTQ and ally teen Shabbaton in the summer of 2012, the next year. And they connected me to E.D. Klein, our CEO, and she suggested that I get involved in helping plan that. And that was really how I first started getting involved in Keshet. And then my senior year of college, I interned with Keshet and then joined the team full time in the summer of 2017, right after I graduated, and have been working on our program supporting LGBTQ Jewish middle school students, high school students, and young adults in the 5 years since.
I'm really interested, Amram, in that notion that you already mentioned, even in that introduction, about someone tapping you on the shoulder, so to speak, or someone having a conversation with you about what it meant to get involved with Jewish life. And I think many of us can relate to those experiences in our own career trajectories as well. But before we get there, Megan, tell us a bit about yourself.
So I don't think my answer is going to be as clean. I have a very freelance answer. I went to Syracuse University and got a BFA in acting. And I moved to New York City wanting to be a playwright and wanting to be an actor. So this was the job that was available, to put it bluntly. I had a theater background, and then I was getting into the Jewish world. I had worked at Jewish summer camp at Goldman Union Camp in Zionsville, Indiana, three of my summers in college. So this was work that I could do. And then really over time, it became work that I wanted to do and was further drawn into. I could say that there is something freeing about being able to work multiple places and sort of set my own schedule, but that's not what freelance and gig economy work is really like. I actually heard a strategist talk about the gig economy of, it's great because these are people that don't have a wide set of skills. They really don't have enough skills to work a full-time job in the workplace. And the truth is that I feel like every 5 years in the entertainment world, I have had to learn a new kind of writing. And every 3 years in the Jewish education world, I have had to learn a new style of educational teaching. Or to keep myself interested, I have gone, I'm going to create a new curriculum about this, or I'm going to pick up this new skill. What I ended up needing to do was develop skill on top of skill on top of skill on top of skill. And so I do a lot of different things at a lot of different places. I'm a song leader. I'm a classroom teacher. I'm a curriculum writer. I've incorporated sketch comedy. I've incorporated superheroes. I've incorporated game shows. I've also trained with storytelling. And so I write ritual theater. I've been a creative writing specialist, a music specialist, the head of the music program at certain places. And I have worked with kids ages 0 through college at this point, but very freelance actor move into the city story where I needed a job and this was a job.
Amran, I'd love to hear a bit from you about the work that you're currently doing at Keshet.
Yeah, my work centers on a couple of main buckets. The first bucket is our LGBTQ and Ally Teen Shabbaton program, which is now in its 10th year. And that is a series of weekend-long retreats centered on Shabbat for LGBTQ and Ally Jewish teens, created by LGBTQ and Ally Jewish teens. And a lot of my work there is focused on helping support the youth leaders, our Shabbaton co-chairs, and their steering committee in creating the programs and facilitating the programs and helping connect them to other staff members who can help coach them and helping guide them in the process of going from vague ideas that they have about the types of conversations and the programs they want to have to fully sussed out ideas that they can then present and facilitate with and for their peers. The second part is our online programs, which, like our Shabbaton programming, is created almost entirely by LGBTQ Jewish teens and young adults for their peers, or guided at least by their ideas in terms of the conversations that they want to have. So thinking about, what does it mean to be a young LGBTQ Jewish person and living at the intersection of these two identities and communities? And what are the types of conversations that we want to have together? What are the things that we want to do when we're all in the same space together, either in person at a Shabbaton or virtually? And actually giving them the tools and the space that they need to do that. And so that takes a couple of different forms and has evolved over the last few years that we've been relegated to our online programming. It has taken the form of guest speakers and a speaker series to do different types of workshops, an intro to queer theory. It has also been an informal hangout space that happens every other Monday evening, or an arts program that happens every other week as well as programming specifically for trans and non-binary teens and young adults, and a space specifically for LGBTQ Jews ages 18 to 24. And the goal of all of my programming really is to support LGBTQ Jews, to really be put in the driver's seat, so to speak, and giving them access to the leadership and the space that they need to have the conversations that they want to have together and the programs that they want to see that explore what it means to live at the intersection of these two identities and communities.
So Amran, I want to follow up with you with a broader question, but I'm really fascinated by this concept because you added the word allies onto LGBTQ, and then you said, and allies. And I'm wondering the question of inclusivity and diversity in the Jewish world today, and specifically asking you the question, like, are LGBTQ youth wanting to be doing separate programming by themselves, or are they wanting to be integrated into all Jewish programming, or is there a place for both? But I'd like to hear your understanding of, like, why there's a need for a separate space, particularly for LGBTQ youth these days.
The answer is both. And other coworkers of mine at Keshet focus on creating spaces outside of my work in the Jewish community, in synagogues and GCCs and camps and day schools, that are affirming equitable spaces for LGBTQ Jews of all ages. I think that especially right now, as we see the rise of legislations and policies all over the country in different states that specifically target LGBTQ youth, like the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida, or other bills and policies that specifically target transgender and non-binary youth, there is still an incredible need for LGBTQ youth to come together and be with each other and build community together and think about what does it mean to actually build the type of Jewish community that we want to see. And that is often one of the guiding questions that we have in our programming is, how is what we're doing together in this space helping us build a vision for a more equitable, more justice-oriented Jewish community?
So our listeners don't actually know this, but Jessica had to momentarily step up to go out on a lockdown drill that was taking place in her synagogue. And I think in some ways that is completely emblematic of some of the changes that have taken place in Jewish education in recent years. But Jessica's intro was that she now works for an organization, a synagogue that's 180 years old. So Jessica, I'm going to ask you just to briefly reflect upon what are some of the biggest changes taking place in synagogue education today that you're bearing witness to and that you're actually involved with as well?
I will do my best to answer that very large question. So some of the changes I've noticed, even in the 7 years since I finished graduate school, is a much bigger focus on addressing the needs of the children and families in our community in real time, as opposed to trying to focus the experiences we give them on themes or topics that are, you know, tried and true. Like, instead of putting a focus on prayer and history and Israel, which are all wonderful things to learn about and experience, to really looking at what do our families and our children need right now. And that's what we certainly try to do with our program, instead of trying to fit in the pieces of learning how to thrive in a community, which can be really challenging. That's the main focus. And I think that's definitely something different than when I entered congregational learning, gosh, when I was 18 years old. So that's the main thing I see.
Megan, I want you to come in here on a topic which Jessica just raised, that being the one of tefillah. And I know this is an area of focus for you. And I'm wondering, like, if you could talk to us about the role of tefillah, the role of prayer in today's educational structure and for today's youth, and maybe even talk about the way in which music and prayer intersect and become really meaningful and impactful in the lives of young people today and the work that you're doing.
Absolutely. I'm a camp Jew. I come from the URJ camp system. I went to Gucci, I went to Kutz, and I've worked at several different camps now. And so for me, music has always been a huge part about connecting with Judaism, because it's something that is utilized very often in the camps, and especially at Goldman Union Camp, which was my home camp. So tefillah and prayer is hard for me to separate from music. And obviously there is music that is not tefillah and prayer, and there is tefillah and prayer that is not music. But especially in the Reform and the Reconstructionist movements, and largely in the conservative movements, and I'm working in all of them, there's a huge overlap. The way we are teaching tefillah and connection to God and connection to each other is by using music. And there's, of course, the very old way that we do things of chanting. And so there's this wonderful tying into tradition. But there's also all of these new musical tunes that a number of places I work, like Society for the Advancement of Judaism and Temple Emmanuel, are constantly going, okay, well, what's this new version of the Misha Berach? Or what's this new version of Osei Shalom that we can bring in? And I am personally a fan, and I know that our cantor at Emmanuel is a fan of sometimes then mashing up some of these Jewish prayers or Jewish songs with a musical theater tune or a folk song. And so we integrate this very old, very sacred ritual into something that is tangible and recognizable today.
So I think I want to ask this question of all of you, because I believe that it's fundamental in many ways to Jewish education today, and specifically to your work, that all of you have spoken about the work that you're doing directly with young people today and the impact that you're having on their lives. But I think the pandemic taught us something else, which we already probably knew, but reminded us of in a really significant way, that Jewish education for young people today is as much or as important for their families as it actually is for the youth themselves. And I'm wondering if each of you could speak to the ways in which you involve families along this journey with the youth that you're teaching today, and how you've seen that progress and developed in recent times as well. So let's start with you, Jessica, talking about families and your role as a congregational educator.
Yeah, it's really important to involve families. Obviously, when kids come to our program, they're here on their own, but the reinforcement of what they're doing and the greater hope is that they are talking about what they experience with us around the dinner table with their family or coming to our Shabbat services with their family. Everything we do really benefits and is more deeply ingrained when it is a full family way of living. So we have tried some different things since the pandemic, you know, forced us to be more separate. Thankfully, we're being able to come back in person more and more now. We just had an entire day's worth of programming with families to highlight what's available for them in our congregation. But it was really difficult to engage families when we were all on Zoom and everyone was distanced.
Megan, can you talk about the role of family in the work that you're doing?
Yes. I am fortunate in that at the Society for the Advancement of Judaism, I am teaching a class for the youngest kids and their parents. And it's essentially a sing-along and there's storytelling and I use a lot of puppets. But I consider it my job to not just be engaging the 0 to 5-year-olds. It is just as important to me that the adults be engaged in the program as it is the kids. And that's important for a couple of reasons. There's the very practical level that it's the adults in the room that are making the choice to show up every week. And so if we want to retain people in the program, I want the adults to be having a good time. There's also that I'm a big fan of Pixar movies and entertainment that hits on multiple levels. So it's really nice to be able to pull out a puppet that speaks in a funny voice and does funny things and is entertaining to the kids in that way, but that is making references and jokes about random things like copyright law that only the parents in the room are going to get. But then it's giving them a unique experience as it's giving their kid a unique experience. And as we all laugh together. One of the goals is that you hope the parents are going to meet other parents and become friends. And that's easier to accomplish when the parents are laughing at a joke together or diving in and singing together. And so I try to address and involve the parents as much as I'm involving the kids.
Amram, I'm going to hesitate to guess that the role of parents is very different for you in some ways, and you're probably making some real distinctions about when it's really appropriate and when it's not appropriate for parents to be involved or families to be involved in the education of the young people you're working with. But let me hear from you.
Yeah, I think I come from a very different context because unlike Jessica and Megan, I'm not involved in synagogue work professionally, at least not through Keshet. But I work with teens who have incredible, wonderful, supportive parents and siblings and families, and also teens and young adults who come to our programming, especially our online programming, whose parents might not be that supportive of the fact that they're LGBTQ. And being able to think about how to support different kinds of teens who have different kinds of experiences of family and acceptance in their home lives is something that has actually become much more of a conversation because so many teens were all stuck at home, like the rest of us were in much of 2020 and the first bit of 2021. I think a lot of the things that I'm thinking about now is as we continue to build on our programming for LGBTQ Jewish youth and expand the ways that we're thinking about engaging LGBTQ Jewish youth around the country, how are we also doing that? And that's something that is still an evolving thing. Other coworkers of mine at Keshet are actually working on doing programming specifically for grandparents who are interested in advocacy work and are interested in doing work around legislative advocacy, specifically around the country. And so they're working on building that up, which has been really amazing to see is teens that I work with bringing their grandparents into our programming and into Keshet's work and saying, like, I want to be in this work with you. And while I focus on specifically empowering LGBTQ Jews ages 13 to 24, I have coworkers who are working on engaging their grandparents who have a lot of ideas and are really excited about engaging in this work and picking up this new fight that is happening around the country around LGBTQ rights as they get challenged in different states and in different ways.
So I imagine you've also seen, Amram, the increase in pressures and mental health issues with the youth that you're dealing with as well. I'm wondering if you can talk at all about mental health awareness and what role that plays in the work that you're doing today as well, specifically.
Yeah, we are not specifically trained as mental health practitioners and professionals at Keshet. And we spend a lot of time thinking about how we can support teens who need additional mental health support beyond what we can provide. A lot of what we think about here at Keshet is that we are providing informal social support and connecting LGBTQ Jews to each other. American Jews are 2-3% of the U.S. population. LGBTQ teens within that are just a tiny fraction of a percentage. And many of our teens felt really isolated, like a lot of teens did. Some were grateful to be stuck at home over COVID because they were bullied at school and were safer at home. And for some, it was the exact opposite. And so providing opportunities for them to gather together and actually having productive conversations and spaces where they could share stories of empowerment, stories of challenges that they were facing is part of how we do that and how we combat some of the mental health challenges that we know are present in LGBTQ communities and specifically for young LGBTQ people. I think also something that is really important for us is that we have a lot of data that shows that being a part of faith communities and being part of religious communities can be a tremendous source of support and stability for both young people and adults. And LGBTQ people in faith communities, when they're not accepted by their religious communities and by specifically in our context in Jewish spaces, those mental health risks are compounded. And so part of our work is actually helping create spaces where LGBTQ young people can have positive Jewish experiences and connections to the Jewish community, because we know how helpful being a part of a religious community can be and what it means to be connected to LGBTQ peers who are part of the same religious group, who are part of the Jewish community, who are from maybe different denominations or different parts of the Jewish community, but are able to come together and build those positive experiences together. And also meet LGBTQ Jewish adults who are engaging with their Jewish lives and communities and identities in different creative ways that reflect the diversity of the Jewish community that we see and within our small community, within a small community within the U.S.
So Jessica or Megan, do any of you have any reflections about issues surrounding mental health? Because I know that's been prevalent both amongst the people that we teach and also the staff and the adults whom we work with. So either of you want to come in on that question?
Yeah, we certainly have always wanted to be a place where our children, our congregants, our teachers feel comfortable, not to say that we don't push them to, you know, stretch their boundaries, but this is a place where we want people to show up as themselves and not feel like they have to put on a happy face, right? Like toxic positivity is a thing. And we really have tried to educate our teaching staff, educate our professional staff and our children about ways to recognize your emotions, ways to regulate those emotions, teaching strategies when you feel like you are just hitting a wall and having one of those hard days. Skills that can really help you get through that moment and recognize that feelings are real, but they also come and go. So it's something that we really put a focus on as a professional staff. It's something that we focus on with our teachers and in turn with our children all of the time.
And Megan?
Yeah, I agree with so much of what Jessica has just said. And I will add on that one of the things I noticed during the pandemic was an increase in parents opening up to me about how they were feeling or what the stressors were in their lives or speaking about this is what our family is dealing with. And some of that is because I was directly calling home for Temple Emmanuel and checking in to get these kind of answers and this kind of information. But I quickly discovered that often my job was not actually to answer questions. It was just to listen and affirm. There was a lot of fear about we're not involved enough or we're overwhelmed and they need someone to say, and it's completely true, you do what works for you. This is not regular school. You're not getting graded on this. We're here to support you as a community. That's what the Jewish community is supposed to be here for. And so obviously there's a lot that needs to be taken into consideration with the mental health and the burnout and the capacities of kids. But it's also true of their parents and of entire families.
So question without notice, folks, because I really want to try and uncover something here, which I know many of us as educators often experience, but rarely get a chance to express. And that's the moment when you're in front of a group of young people, the moment when you're teaching and you actually see the proverbial light bulb go off. Like, how do you know when the magic that you're weaving is actually working? And I'm going to ask each of you perhaps to reflect upon an experience you've had when you've been in front of youth and it's just all clicked and you can see it or you can feel it or you know that something you've done has really, really worked well. So I'm going to ask each of you maybe to tell a brief anecdote of when something has worked really well or the proverbial magic has come into fruition. You got one, Jessica?
So I haven't been a classroom teacher in quite a number of years at this point. So I'm going to give you an example from my work as an administrator with, you know, a whole group of children. But something that comes to mind thinking about seeing that like light bulb moment or that really special communal experience after watching kids put in a lot of hard work is a sixth grade Torah service siyum that we used to do every year that we will hope to get back to in the very near future, where these kids get the first chance after they've been learning trope to actually look at verses from the Torah, lead a Torah service and chant for their families and congregation. And the first year that we did it, after, you know, watching them put in weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks of practice, seeing them get up there and so confidently lead a service and chant from the Torah was, and seeing the joy in their parents' faces, it was one of those moments for me that definitely affirms that I am doing what I hope to be doing. And it certainly gives me fuel to continue doing what I do. I like draw back to those moments whenever I'm at a rough part of the year or I've got a lot of things on my to-do list that just seem never ending. So that communal moment with those sixth graders is something that definitely stands out to me.
Thanks so much. Megan, do you have something to share with us?
Absolutely. I think that as much as we as educators try to plan for these kinds of moments, I have found that they often happen unexpectedly. I have a philosophy essentially that there's Torah and then everything else is Midrash. And by that, I don't just mean Midrash is Midrash. I mean like comic books are Midrash and The Simpsons are Midrash and anything else that you could pull into your life is Midrash. And so we as teachers, I think, are so often focused on like the core Torah when the moments are happening as these breakthrough Midrash moments. And I had an unexpected moment with a four-year-old on Zoom in 2020, where I had a puppet and the puppet was introducing themselves, and Millie introduced themselves and said, "My name is Millie and my pronouns are they, them." And this four-year-old went, "Those are weird pronouns." And I didn't speak as Megan. I didn't speak as the adult. I spoke as the other four-year-old puppet. And so Millie responded and went, "Oh, well, that really hurts my feelings when you say that to me." And then Millie began to explain why they have their pronouns. Some people feel like girls and some people feel like boys, but I don't really feel like either. And so this is what I like. This is how I identify. And this four-year-old just goes, "Oh, okay." Like it was a completely natural, understandable thing. And I think we can get worked up that we are hoping for a particular response, but very often these things can be easier and more joyful than we anticipate them being, especially if we're willing to kind of improvise in the moment.
This summer, I'm coming up on 5 years of full-time work at Keshet, which is a great milestone that I'm excited about. And something that I have been reflecting on a lot the last few weeks is that some of the oldest teens that I worked with when I first started at Keshet in 2016 and 2017, first as an intern and then full-time, have now graduated college or are about to finish college and are beginning to pursue their own careers. And meeting alums of the programs that I've worked on for the last 5-6 years as a professional and 10 years first as a teen and then as a volunteer, and seeing the directions that those now no longer teens, now adults, go into, the ways in which they choose to get involved in Jewish life, the ways in which they have decided to forge their paths forward, and the knowledge that, at least I think a little bit, that I helped contribute to that has been something that feels really special to me. And so meeting alums of programs who are graduating and are thinking about pursuing careers in the rabbinate, or are involved in their hillels on campus, or are pursuing other careers related to social justice, to Jewish communal life, has been really special. And seeing the ways in which those relationships have grown and changed as they go from my participants to alums of the program that I work on to some of them now colleagues of mine is really special. I don't know if I have like a particular light bulb moment that I can point to, like Jessica and Megan just did, but the interactions that I get to have with people who are in college, who are thinking critically about the conversations that we had once, who are pursuing those different careers, and the knowledge that I hope I get to say that like there was like some part of what I did with them or the work that we did together all those years ago is really special to me.
So let's look forward to the future a bit now and give you all a platform to talk about one wish that you have for the future of Jewish education today. What would it be? What do you want our listeners to know about you and your vision moving forward in Jewish education? Jessica, maybe you get us started here.
Sure. Something that I really hope for the future of Jewish education, certainly something that I focus on, is really giving skills to the children who are in our program, being a place where they are welcome and comfortable. And I hope that we continue to evolve with whatever their ongoing needs may be. I would hope that Jewish education as a whole, as it has done over so many years, continues to transform and really think what is most needed right now, as opposed to what are we comfortable with, what are we used to, what do we know has worked in the past, but really looking at what will benefit our communities and our kids every day moving forward, whatever that may be, who knows.
Megan, what about you? What are your hopes and visions for the future?
I'm a big fan of the work that Keshet does actually in terms of upping inclusivity and making sure that everyone feels they have a home. And so I think continuing that, and not just in the sense of gender and sexual identity, but I know that my Jewish background tends to default to Ashkenazi as the norm. And I know that there has been a push recently, and really a push for generations, but perhaps now Ashkenazi Jews are paying more attention to understand that the Jewish experience is not one kind of experience, that Judaism is a communal experience and an individual experience. But we often, without realizing it, default to a communal experience that we are used to as the worldwide Jewish communal experience. And so I would love to see more inclusivity surrounding gender, surrounding sexuality, surrounding race, ethnicity, and even different ideas about Judaism. I think that it's very easy to get caught up in a one particular political ideology or one particular way of teaching. And I think that the more things we can try to find, as Jessica was saying, what works for the individual and what works for the individual communities, so that while pluralism is essentially impossible, how can we get as close to that? How can we have the biggest possible tent where everyone is also feeling like they are individually connected?
Thank you. And Amram, what are your hopes and dreams for Jewish education moving forward?
I think Megan took a lot of what I was going to say, but I want to build off of that. I feel really grateful to be able to work with LGBTQ Jews who are building a better, more justice-oriented, equitable vision for what it means to be a part of the Jewish community, what the Jewish community can look like when we take our values of inclusivity, of equity, of justice, and actually bringing them to the fore, and also taking historically marginalized groups like LGBTQ Jews and giving them access and power to build the types of communities that they want to see. And my hope is that we continue to do this and that we work to make sure that other historically marginalized groups are also empowered, and that we see that as like core to our mission, and that our work, and that I, as someone who holds identities that are not marginalized, still see that as like part of what it means to be a part of a better, more liberated Jewish community. I think also, David, you brought this up earlier. This is something that we talk about a lot in our work, is that allyship and solidarity work is not just how other people can be allies to us, but how we can leverage our privilege that we hold in our identities, how I, as a white person, or I, as a man, can use my privilege to work with others, and that we see that as like core to our work as well, is that this is not just about other people being allies to us, but how we can leverage our skills, our power, our ideas, and empower and support others as well, and be a part of a larger communal movement to bring this vision into reality.
So I'm wondering if each of you could reflect briefly on what it means to be a recipient of the Young Pioneer Award. Amram, let's hear from you.
I think I feel, as someone who's in the earlier stages of my career in Jewish education and Jewish communal work, feel really honored and grateful to be a part of a group of people who are being recognized for their work earlier on in their careers in the Jewish community. I also feel really indebted to a lot of the teachers and mentors that have helped get me to this point, that have empowered me to take chances and take risks and build new things, especially over the last few years. A lot of what I've been reflecting on has been the opportunity to create new things, and not that COVID is necessarily worth it after all, that's not what I'm trying to say, but being able to really have access to the ability to take risks, to try new things, to build upon new ideas and programs, and to really try and experiment and see what works, what do we need to do now, what can we build upon, what success have we had before, where can we grow, and where can we go from where we were before? And this feels like a recognition of a lot of that over the last few years.
And Megan, what does it mean to you to be a recipient of this award?
It's incredibly affirming. It's nice to know that I'm doing a lot of different things in a lot of different places. And I'm very often not making things up as I go along, but to a certain degree, going, here's a thing that I think would strengthen this. Here's a thing that I think I could be doing better. And I am often in conversation with specific individuals that I work with. So being recognized at an institutional level is, again, very affirming, and especially from a community that was helpful to me in terms of resources and brainstorming and support in the last several years.
I'm really grateful to be a recipient of the award. If I'm being honest, you know, the transition from COVID was really difficult and challenging. I work with a really incredible team. We do so much together, and I'm fortunate to have so many like-minded people in my day-to-day, but to be recognized individually for what goes into all of that teamwork is really special to me. So it's a great honor.
Great. Thank you all so much. And now we get to the part of the episode where I get you all to pay tribute to an educator who has made an incredible or indelible impression on you and your career trajectory. So I want to hear from all of you about the one person or a person who you think has made a significant contribution to getting you to where you are today. Amram, let's start with you.
Wow. I have had a lot of not so great experiences in your community, but I'm where I am today because of so many different amazing educators and mentors of mine who pushed me. And one of them was my first supervisor at Keshet, Justin Rosen-Smolin, who used to work at the Jewish Education Project, who really saw potential in me, took me on as an intern, and really pushed me to really grow professionally. I met him first when I was probably 20 or 21, and we started working together my senior year of college. And it was him believing in me and pushing me to grow and to really flex my skills as a facilitator, as an educator, that brought me to where I am today, and the ways in which he helped me navigate challenging interactions I had and challenging moments in my work at Keshet, but also celebrating the wins and celebrating the successes.
Was not expecting you to be able to shout out one of our former employees, but also someone who I work with closely, who taught me a lot about the world in which we live in today and what Jewish education can offer, particularly to LGBTQ youth, but also so many other issues that are facing Gen Z today as well. So I'll shout out to Justin as well in this particular episode. So Megan, who's someone in your life that you would like to pay tribute to?
One of the first people that I met in the Jewish professional community when I moved to New York City, and in fact, before I had even moved, because she was one of the primary leaders at my storytelling training, was Naomi Less. And part of the reason I do anything I do is because she actually had worked with my father, and my father was bemoaning the fact that I was about to move to New York City and try to be an actor and try to be a playwright. And how is this really going to work? And Naomi said, oh, well, she should join storytelling. Like, that's a natural fit. Theater and Judaism overlapping. And that really became not just a focus, but a career. And I admire Naomi specifically as an educator and as a musician, but also as someone who understands the professional aspect as much as they understand the spiritual aspect, in that when you are a gig employee or a freelancer, a lot of what you have to do is recognize your worth and advocate for yourself. And I think that Naomi is a tremendous advocate for the community. She is a tremendous advocate for individual kids that she works with. And she also knows her strengths and is brilliant at playing to those strengths and building those strengths to be even stronger over the course of her ongoing career. So I am frequently thinking about, well, what would Naomi say about this? Maybe that's the decision I want to make as I choose to sign this contract or build this program.
So no pressure now on you, Jessica, because now we're two for two, because Naomi was one of the first Jewish educators that I met when I came to the United States. And I was actually involved with a fellowship that she was in as well through Brandeis University. And she was really one of the first people that taught me about the important role that music could play in Jewish education, and not just as an add-on, but actually as the Jewish education itself. So now I'm also going to hat tip to Naomi for being one of my teachers as well. Jessica, no pressure.
All right, I'll see what I can do. So I have benefited from so many fantastic educators in my life. The person I will shout out now is Nancy Parks. She hired me for my first job out of graduate school, and I learned so much working with her and learning with her for the 2 years that we were together. She introduced me to the language of social emotional learning, which was something I felt connected to right from the moment I started learning about it. And I have been really grateful to the continued learning that I'm able to do with her. Even after moving on to work at Rhoda Shalom, she's just been an incredible educator person to have.
So our audience is not going to believe this, but we're now 3 for 3 because Nancy Parks is certainly one of the educators who has been most inspiring for me, especially in the work of congregational learning from her days working up at Temple Israel Center in Westchester. She's always been a good friend and colleague of mine and of the Jewish Education Project, and certainly one of the leading lights that led the way to explaining and trying to push that social emotional intelligence is integral to what we do as Jewish educators, and that for Jewish education to be successful, that it really needs to take that as really a pillar and a platform central to everything that it does. Look, it's been a really tremendous opportunity today for me to get to know all of you and to be able to honor all of the work that you're doing, not just for yourselves, but for the institutions that you work for and with who are doing such incredible work. The Jewish world is certainly a lot stronger because of the presence that you're all having. And something that I mentioned last week, and I want to reiterate again today, although we call it the Young Pioneer Awards, that's a reference only to your chronological age. It is also an acknowledgement that the changes that you're making today, the impact you're having today, is critical, and not that you're going to be educators who are stellar and outstanding in the future, but that you really are true award-deserving winners today because of the work that you're doing in the very present in which we all live in. So Amram, Jessica, and Megan, thanks today for a great conversation. It's been great to learn more about you all, and I urge all of our listeners to have a look at this episode and the show notes attached to it, as well as to the first part of this special series from last week that honors the Young Pioneer Award recipients, Francie and Emily, as well. So thanks to all of you for joining us here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Today's episode was produced by Dina Nussenbaum and Gabriel Weinstein. The show's executive producers are myself, Karen Cummins, and Nessa Lieben. Our show, as always, is engineered and edited by Nathan J. Vaughan of NJV Media. Now, if you enjoyed today's session of Adapting as much as I did, please leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, or even better still, share it with a friend and leave us a comment as well. It does make the world of difference to be able to share the experiences and expertise of our award winners and so many of our other guests with all of your friends. As always, you can learn more about the Jewish Education Project by logging onto our website at jewishedproject.org. There you can find out about our mission, our history, our staff, and the Young Pioneer Award winners. And as always, we are proud to be a partner of UJ Federation of New York. Thanks everyone for listening today.